Welcome to the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of August the 5th, 2019. Current Federal Tax Developments are brought to you this week, as always, by Kaplan Financial Education and by your State Society of CPAs. This week, we're going to look at a few developments that took place during the past week, including the IRS sending out about 10,000 letters regarding some Bitcoin or other cryptocurrency transactions that taxpayers, well, they might have forgotten to report. And so the IRS is sending out letters to remind you of this. The IRS also put together some relief that affects taxpayers for that short stub that we had when we had bonus depreciation and went back into 2017. Remember, most TCJA things took effect on January 1st of 2018, but you had bonus depreciation issues that went into 2017. We have some abilities to change our elections on that return. We have also, as well, the IRS put out a draft Schedule K-1 this week for Form 1120-S. And that draft form makes some changes in how we report Section 199 Cap A information. And so we'll talk briefly about that. We also had the IRS issuing a private letter ruling that an affected company released a little bit before the IRS is going to release it on their site that approved for partial medical expense payments made for DNA testing. And finally, we're going to close out looking at an organization that was found not to operate exclusively for charitable purposes, and because of that, lost their status as a 501c3 organization. Well, all kinds of stuff coming up here in August, and I'm heading toward, on the 14th of August, we're going to have courses here in Phoenix. On the 14th, have a course on income taxation of trusts and estates. On the 15th, we'll have a course that kind of looks at a number of issues that are key tax planning concepts and issues. We'll talk about that. Basically, some of the how-to of tax planning, as well as some of the issues that we have to worry about planning about these days. And finally, on the 16th, I'll have a course on partnership and LLC taxation advanced issues. That'll be in Phoenix at the Arizona Society offices, and also will be broadcast on the web. Then I will go the next Monday to not actually Mount Rushmore, but South Dakota. When you ask for a South Dakota graphic, you know, in terms of my stock photo group, this is what they came up with initially, so we have it. So a little bit further, the other side of the state, but still, we will be in Sioux Falls, South Dakota in August. And on the 19th, I'll be doing a session on preparing complex 1040s, and that deals with a lot of issues that come up on returns that are the type of returns that a CPA is going to see, as opposed to having them show up at some, you know, storefront preparer. So we'll talk about issues that relate to Section 199 Cap A. We'll talk about issues relating to what is left of the alternative minimum tax. Talk about some what's left of 1031 exchanges. Also talk about net operating losses and a few other details that'll be of interest. And on August 20th, we'll have the advanced partnership issues featuring the new partnership audit regime. That's a course that talks about a number of advanced partnership issues, somewhat similar to what I'm going to be doing on Friday in Phoenix, but we're going to spend time initially and spend time basically concentrating on the new partnership audit regime that took effect for 2018 returns. And we're going to talk about where we stand on that, what issues are there, and what issues remain on the partnership audit regime as we move forward. Well, with that, let's get started with this week's developments. The first key development came from the IRS news release issued on the 26th of July. This is news release 2019-132. And that news release was the IRS going back into the area of cryptocurrency. The IRS told us in this news release they have sent out a letter to over 10,000 taxpayers, telling those taxpayers that, well, it could be informative, or it could be we need you to tell us something, but you're getting a letter that for some reason the IRS has concerns about maybe you haven't quite reported your cryptocurrency transactions the way you should have. There are three different letter types that are coming out, and which one you get is really important. The first one, and the one you do not want to get, is the letter 6173. 6173 is one that asks you for action. They tell you that the IRS believes you have failed to report, in essence, or not properly reported, various cryptocurrency transactions. Based on that, they want you to basically submit information to them, either correcting your return if you failed to properly report everything on it, or telling them why you believe your return is correct as reported. If you fail to respond, the letter tells you that essentially, you're going to get a nice little notice of exam coming at you. So this particular letter, 6173, is one that you're not going to want to ignore if a client gets it. The next letter in the line is probably, of the three, the one you'd prefer to get the most. Not that you like getting any of these, but 6174, that particular letter, and by the way, we have links to these letters in the materials that you can download from our website. This particular letter, though, the 6174, simply tells you we think maybe you're not aware of the proper proper taxation of cryptocurrency transactions. And just in case, here's kind of some details of how they're done. Here's some information. If you want to review your return, if you discover after reviewing this that maybe you hadn't reported things right, well, you probably should send an amended return. Okay? But it's more general. It's more just like we're not saying we have reason to believe you didn't report something. We just aren't sure if you understand. You know, want to make sure we know. In essence, the way I read this letter is, we know you have a cryptocurrency account. Yes, this probably relates to the whole Coinbase situation. We know you have the account, but we didn't see anything obvious. It wasn't reported, but we want you to know basically how they should be reported when you do finally have something reportable. Finally, the third category is letter 6174A. That letter similarly says, you know, we want to make sure you understand how this is taxed, but it does intimate that they have reason to believe that you may not have properly reported some of the transactions. Nevertheless, the letter does not come down and say that if you don't respond to this thing, we're going to give an examination. It doesn't give you a deadline for response. It just says if you find a problem, you should probably file an amended return. That one's kind of in the middle letter. So you have these three different letters. You need to worry about them. One key thing I want to tell you about is, remember, if you're not licensed as an attorney, you do not have any sort of privilege in a criminal tax matter. Why do I say that? Because trying to hide large amounts of funds in Bitcoin offshore so you don't report the income really kind of sounds close to criminal activity. And you need to be very careful that clients don't start telling you things that you can't unhear. And by that I mean, it's not that you're going to go tell the service right away about these things, but the problem is if you're subpoenaed, it's got to be told. So you want to make sure if you have clients come in, especially clients who get the first letter, I would suggest that, you know, if there's any chance there was something, you did something, there's something you haven't told me about your cryptocurrency transactions, don't tell me now. Go talk to an attorney, get this taken care of, and when we finally, you know, and then we'll try to figure out later what this means, you know, after the attorney clears it with you. Maybe the attorney will tell you that, hey, we're fine, this is okay, don't worry about it. Or maybe they'll say, yeah, there's a bigger problem. But you want to make sure you don't become your client's worst enemy by being down here having, you know, taking care of this stuff and trying to help them, but end up making things worse. If you're not sure about proper taxation of cryptocurrency, the IRS and news release basically tells you that Notice 2014-21 tells you the proper treatment. Basically, that ruling told us that cryptocurrency is property just like any other. It's not considered to be currency. So you don't report it using currency rules, you report it using the rules for property. So that means when you acquire Bitcoin, you know, if you acquire Bitcoin because you exchange something, well, that's a sale, and you report that income. If you then hold that Bitcoin for 3 weeks and then sell it, that's going to be a sale. It's going to generate, in most cases, capital gain or loss, and that capital gain or loss ends up being reported on Schedule D. And if you hold it for over a year, it'd be long-term capital gain or loss. That's basically how it works. If you're mining, mining creates ordinary income. That's what that notice told us. The big thing missing from that notice is how you deal with things like the hard forks. And for those of you who have been involved in cryptocurrency, you know what a hard fork is. Basically, we split up the system so that we're going to go different ways. Now, one cryptocurrency stays in the old system. This was best known, the Bitcoin Cash hard fork is one of the best known hard forks. and everybody who had Bitcoin ended up with Bitcoin Cash. When we started this, the question becomes, how do you account for the Bitcoin Cash being received? Is this a taxable transaction? If so, how did you value it? How do you value the basis? All of that is still missing. The IRS is promising that real soon now, they're going to get us some guidance on this stuff. But the letters are going around right now without that guidance. So keep your eyes on it. The commissioner later in the week was reported by tax analysts to essentially be telling people they probably shouldn't ignore these letters. If you get them, you should do something. In essence, the implication is, if your client got these letters, there's something the IRS knows. It may just know, to be totally honest, that they have an account. It may be that they know that there appears to have been some sales that should have been reported, or it may be they have reason to believe that they actually are essentially hiding income by getting income from Bitcoin, but not, you know, Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies, and not actually reporting it. Definitely, they do not think you should ignore the letter. If your client has it, you know, you should discuss the issues, probably discuss what's there. If your client gets the 6174 letter, then have a discussion and see if the real issue is that, let's say, they had purchased a cryptocurrency, or they deposited cryptocurrency with someplace like Coinbase, but they hadn't actually done any sales. And probably the idea there would be they purchased it. My guess is the IRS will send the third letter if it looks like somebody deposited it, because depositing Bitcoin might suggest to them that, well, how did you earn it? You know, how did you get the Bitcoin? So that might explain the third letter, the one that says, just in case you didn't report things, here's how you should. We'll go down that path. But clients do have to understand how Bitcoin's taxes, or Bitcoin and other cryptocurrency, is taxed. And yes, please remember, there's more than just Bitcoin in the world. So you have different cryptocurrencies to deal with. The IRS now in Revenue Procedure 2019-33 gave us some relief from the rules that we have for reporting bonus depreciation. Those of you may remember when the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act came in, one thing that happened was we had a big change, and the change in bonus, unlike the other change, took place for any assets placed in service after September 27th of 2017. Well, this notice affects essentially the tax years that begin on September the 28th of 2017. And what it does there is it allows you to make certain elections late, or change your elections. There are three key elections that are involved in this that you're allowed to make late. The first one is if you're in this area, there was 179 certain plants and grafting of plants. Those expenses related to that were added as eligible 179 assets if the taxpayer elected to treat them as 179, but bonus depreciation assets. So if the taxpayer did elect to take that treatment, you know, they want to take it now, but maybe they hadn't originally because, you know, the tax year ended, especially let's say if you had a September year in and you did something September 29th, you might not have even figured out by the time you filed the return that there was this change. Now you figured it out. If you want to make that election, the IRS allows you to do so now. There actually are three ways to make it. If, in fact, we talk about this one for plants, maybe you just reported bonus depreciation, but you didn't realize that you were supposed to make a specific election, a specific statement. Well, if you did that, essentially, and you didn't actually attach the election you should have. By the way, for later years, you do need to attach that election. But if you failed to attach that election, IRS said for that year that contains September the 28th, if you claimed 100% bonus, we're going to treat you as if you made that election on the qualifying plants. So if you made it for those, that's fine. If you filed the return, you didn't deduct bonus depreciation, and now you want to make the election, you in fact didn't know about it, you didn't take it, and so you didn't fail and made the election, but now you're like, yeah, we really should have done that bonus depreciation on those expenses and costs related to those plants. Well, if that's what you've decided, you're allowed now to make that election. If you've not yet filed your tax return for the year after the year that includes September 28, 2017, and so for most taxpayers, that would be the 2018 calendar year return. If that return is still an extension, you can amend the 2017 return. You amend it, you claim the proper depreciation on the 17 return, And then you can go ahead and, you know, claim the, and there won't be anything left because it's 100% bonus. So you don't claim anything on the 18 return. If you've already filed the 18 return, or if you just want to go this route, the IRS will allow you to treat it as a change in accounting method in either the first, second, or third year after the year containing September 28, 2017. So for calendar year taxpayers 18, 19, and 20. And you can just make a automatic change that goes with the return. You're going to compute a 41A adjustment. That should be a negative adjustment since you're electing to claim the depreciation, and you report that all in the year of change. So you can catch up that way. If you did make the election, you know, you claimed 100%, you made the election, but now you're deciding we shouldn't have done that, then the same two options exist for you now too. If you have not yet filed the return for the year after the year containing September 28, 2017, so again, calendar year taxpayers, you've not yet filed the 18 return, you can amend the 17 return. If you have filed the 18 return or you just want to do it this way, you can undo the election by using Form 3115 change of accounting method. We have similar issues here for the election out of bonus entirely. Remember, we always have that right to elect totally for any class of assets, to not claim bonus for that year. If for some reason you've now changed your mind for that year that contains September 28, 2017, and you want to opt out entirely on bonus for some class, you can do that. Again, the same two ways of doing it. If you've not filed the return for the year after the year containing September 28, 2017, calendar year 2018 returns, for if you're a calendar year taxpayer, then you can just amend last year's return and attach the election and recompute the depreciation properly. Or if you want to use a change of accounting method, or you've already filed the 18 return, then again, for the first, second, or third year after the year containing September 28, 2017, so for calendar year taxpayers 18, 19, and 20, you again can use the 3115. Same basic option if there's a special election that only impacts that year into September 28, 2017. And that would be to use 50% bonus instead of 100% for those assets you acquired after September 27th. So you treat the whole year as 50. If that's what you want to do and you want to treat the whole year as 50, then what ends up happening is if you in fact did treat them as 50 and you don't want to change that, then that's a deemed election. I should add there also a deemed election if you didn't claim bonus and you could have on a class. That's also an option for deemed election. If you did use 50% for everything and you don't want to change that, it's going to be a deemed election. Even though you're supposed to have elected it, we're not going to worry about it. If you want to change your election, so let's say you did take 100% and you want to undo it, then you can file an election again using the same two methods. If you don't have the year after September 28, 2017's return filed yet, so again, calendar year 2018 returns not been filed, you can amend the return. If you don't want to amend the return, you can do a 3115, or if you've already filed the 18 return, you'll do a 3115. It can be for either the first, second, or third year after that year in question, the year containing September 28, 2017. So bottom line, 18, 19, 20 again. The IRS also, at the end of this revenue procedure, gave us a brand new automatic change method. So you have a brand new automatic change method was added, and it basically tells us what we thought. It also said you can make all of these changes on 13115. If you do, you'll have a single net 41A adjustment. So if you need to follow that, that's where the example is about how you do it. You get your document change number there. All the details you need are found in the last part, section 7 of Revenue Procedure Notice 20, Revenue Procedure 2019-33. Now on to draft forms again. We've had a lot of draft forms coming out. This week we got the first 2019 Schedule K-1 draft. This was the draft Schedule K-1 Form 1120S issued on July 25th, 2019. And the interesting issue this year is if you go to the codes on Schedule K-1, you know, the second page, for number 17. Number 17 is the other information. On the 2018 Schedule K-1, we had five different codes for 199 Cap A information. Those were V, W, X, Y, and Z. Well, this year we're going to cut that down on the 19 return to only one code. There's code V that instead of now saying, one code for QBI, one code for UBIA, one code for W-2 wages, one code for REIT, 199 REIT-related payments, one code for 199 Cap A publicly traded partnership amounts. We now are just going to have code V, 199 Cap A information, and it's going to essentially be a schedule. The reality is that basically they're now going to want you to give all the details. If you may remember, we had questions and answers, like question 20, answer 28 on the IRS's frequently asked question page, told us there's a lot of things we might need to adjust. You can't really just take the QBI number from the K-1 and just run with it. And so that subtlety is kind of missed when we only had the five codes. Now we're going to have code V. We're simply going to be told, so under that code, you tell the partner, or I should say, in this case, the shareholder, anything they need to know about what they might need to get 199 Cap A done correctly with the flow through. We don't know as of the moment, but we really would expect that this likely is telling us what's going to show up on the other K-1s. That would be like the K-1 for partnerships on 1065, the K-1 from 1041s for trusts and estates. I would be really surprised to see those also reduced down to a single one-line code, and then you attach a schedule. For 199 Cap A, yeah, the actual codes from last year were too simplified. The IRS eventually decided that actually it's more complex than that. So now we're going to deal with the more complex issue. IRS turns out sometimes, normally we wait for private letter rulings to be published by the IRS on their website, where they've gone through with the redacted version, and I'll give you like a PLR number to work from. But remember, the way the private letter ruling process works is private letter rulings are first given to the taxpayer non-redacted. And so the taxpayer knows the nature of the ruling. From time to time, rulings are sought by companies that maybe want to know how somebody who buys their product should be reporting it for tax purposes. That's the case in what we're going to talk about here. This is a private letter ruling to the company 23andMe. Many of you may be aware 23andMe does genetic testing, DNA testing. It was issued by the IRS to 23andMe on May 16th, and 23andMe released it on their website, and a Wall Street Journal story appeared on July the 22nd. 23andMe offers DNA testing on the web in two different service types. Service type one is what they call ancestry services, and service type two is ancestry and health. The issue that 23andMe was concerned about, they were pretty sure just ancestry was not a medical expense. But how about somebody who went for the extra cost, and it cost basically double? They went for the extra cost and got the ancestry and health version of the test. Could they claim some or all, or how do they compute? Is any of that a medical expense? Which means, could we get reimbursed in a flexible spending account for those payments? Could we take it and pay it from our HSA without getting penalized? Or can we just put it on Schedule A as an itemized deduction? Well, the IRS analyzed this, and actually looking back at some historical rulings, they decided that in fact, A, the fact that an individual requests testing on their own doesn't make something non-deductible medical. You do not need a doctor to recommend the test, diagnostic test be done. Previously, we had revenue ruling that dealt with this in the context of like full body scans, which became popular for people to go out and get done. Now we're going to have it redone in terms of this DNA testing. And then the other issue was, if you're paying for something with a single fee, and it includes both medical and non-medical items, and this ruling went back to fees charged by a university that included their healthcare program. So you got, as a student, you got various things for these fees, for the fees you paid. But one thing you got was access to the healthcare system. And now the question becomes, how much of what you paid is considered deductible medical? And they again said you reasonably allocate between the medical and non-medical. Well, the IRS ruled that that's how this is going to work too. If you pay for the ancestry, now if you pay just for ancestry, IRS did not rule on that, And practical matter is, I think everybody's agreed that that's not going to be medical. But if you go for the ancestry and health version, then you're allowed to reasonably allocate between the two. So you allocate reasonably between the two, the medical and the non-medical portion. Now, of course, that's kind of begs the question, how do we do it? 23andMe on their website, on their blog, says, oh, well, up to $117.74 of the $199 you pay for ancestry and health testing is medical. Now, unfortunately, they don't tell us how they got to that number. Obviously, there's some methodology they're using, and they don't really tell us how to get, you know, how to do others, but they do have a worksheet on their website. They will print up an FSA payment request form. Don't know if every SSA is going to say, yeah, that's good enough for us. But certainly some portion of this, as I said, the way it works, the basic cost is $99 for the ancestry only, $199 for ancestry and health. You know, apparently what this organization has come up with is that the health really is the more expensive of the two. You get a discount for doing it with ancestry because you always have to do ancestry. So essentially, they're going to say the $117 is deductible. For lack of a better term, we'll probably accept that, although you should warn your clients there's no guarantee 117 won't be questioned, but it is what's in there. We do know, though, we have this ruling. Please remember, it affects Schedule A. It would affect healthcare flexible spending accounts that would reimburse these types of expenses, and it would affect an individual's health savings account. Now, since it's a partial pay, please remember, you can't submit the whole $199 through. You would have to submit only the medical portion through for reimbursement. Or if you're doing an HSA, you only want to use the HSA to pay for the medical portion, because a payment for the rest of it would be considered to be a payment for something other than medical care. And if we don't have other medical expenses paid elsewhere, yeah, we're going to get penalized for that and pay tax on the earnings. So, yeah, we need to be a little, actually not just tax on earnings, tax on the whole thing. This is an HSA, so there is no basis. So, interesting rule. We should see the actual private letter ruling. The IRS claims, or I should say 23andMe says, it'll come out this month. It could be this coming week's private letter rulings. It could be those coming out in the next few weeks, but somewhere we'll see and get a real PLR number. That'll be this ruling. But we do have a copy of this ruling available, linked on our website. 23andMe obviously made it available. They've, you know, done the work. So if you want to take a look at it and see how it fits and if it might fit with your client, you can follow the links and find it on our website as to our links back to 23andMe's copy of this private letter ruling. Our final development for this week deals with, we're going to a court case, first court case of the week. And this is the case of Giving Hearts, Inc. versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2019-94, issued on July the 29th. Now, this is a problem. If you're a 501c3 organization, there are two things you got to worry about. First thing is, were you formed for an appropriate purpose? Okay. In this case, Giving Hearts is going to be found to be formed for an appropriate purpose. They cleared the application for exemption. The IRS granted it. But the second problem is you have to also operate properly. And your operations must be basically, you know, exclusively for exempt purposes. If any significant part of your operations is for a non-exempt purpose, then you fail the operational test. Those of you who do qualified retirement plans, this should all sound familiar because they're another tax-exempt entity. And again, remember there, we got the same two pair of things. First thing is your document okay? And then the second issue is, how do you operate? Do your operations cause you not to be okay? This is going to be a problem in this case with operations. This was an idea that a certain taxpayer came up with to solve not a tax problem, but a non-tax problem. The taxpayer in this question had a company. The company sold replacement windows and various home improvements. They had been doing really well being those wonderful telemarketers that get on the phone, right? You know, you go to pick up, they're selling anything. This was back before the FTC put together the Do Not Call registry. where you register your number. We all know now that hasn't really, didn't really work. As long as you're willing to violate the law, it's not a problem. And we all discover there's a whole bunch of people willing to violate the law. Even as I was recording this session, I noticed that I got one of those nice fake calls on my cell phone. So, people still violate, but this company wasn't going to try to violate. They just, though, need a way to work around, because a good part of their sales came from these telemarketing calls, and now they were prohibited from doing it because most of the people they wanted to call put their numbers on the Do Not Call registry. Well, the owner looked at it, one of the major owners of the company, looked around and said, you know what? Charitable entities are not limited by the Do Not Call registry. If you're a charity calling to ask for contributions, we don't care. You can make the call. You can call anybody on the list. So he decided he would form a 501c3 organization. This organization was formed. Its purpose was to solicit contributions and then to, disperse those contributions, to various, various useful charitable organizations throughout the area. It's going to kind of be a, not really quite like a United Way, but in a similar sort of structure where it would make the, it would get the contributions and then it would send those on to other worthy charities. And it actually did so each year. The court tells us when we get here, looking at my numbers for a second, over the years from 2010 to 2016, it made these got monies in and sent them to charities between $1,100 and $8,300 per year. And very little of what it received in contributions went to pay for any expenses. They were very minor. So, I mean, the vast majority of the funds they got went directly to the charity. That all sounds good. But here's where the hitch came. Remember, his problem he's trying to solve is his window replacement company can't make telemarketing calls anymore. So what he did, he had the window company enter into a sponsorship program with the charity. And what he did by that is the window company would essentially place calls on behalf of the charity. And it had this neat script, which actually is in the tax court case. And it said, hello, this is blank, calling on behalf of Giving Hearts. We're a nonprofit organization helping to fund local children's charities. I mean, it sounds good so far, right? We have sponsored the Windows Plus company for purpose of fundraising. For every homeowner that accepts a product demonstration and free estimate, our charity, Giving Heart, will receive a donation from Windows Plus. As you might guess, in order to, no money out of your pocket, but you have to agree to let them come to your home and give you the sales pitch for the windows and for their home improvements. Well, it turned out that some people in Michigan, they were located in Michigan, some people in Michigan thought that this looked a lot like just straight telemarketing, and they filed complaints with the Attorney General's office in Michigan. The Attorney General in Michigan contacted the IRS and said that, they've received all these complaints that this charity may simply be a front for an operation to telemarket window work. And the IRS then notified the organization that they were going to examine them. Well, here comes the catch. As I said, one of the key requirements under 501c3, if you're going to be that type of a charity, is that you have to be operated exclusively for charitable purposes. And the regulations, and in this case, it's going to be Regulation 1.501c-1-1c1, tells us in part that an organization will not be so regarded, that is, operating exclusively for charitable purposes, if more than an insubstantial part of its activities is not in furtherance of an exempt purpose. In this case, the court found a very significant purpose of the operations of this entity was to allow the window company to move windows, to sell the product. Selling product is not an exempt purpose. So even though they really did, every dollar they got went to charity, the reality was they were serving a very non-charitable purpose and non-exempt purpose, and that meant they lost retroactively their 501c3 status, denying a charitable contribution deduction to donors, making this thing taxable, all kinds of things that were not good. Now, the company said, wait, But you see, here's the problem. I mean, I understand the only company we had to do this was Windows Plus, right? You know, our company. But we really did try to get other companies. The only reason we didn't get other companies is because, you know, the Attorney General of Michigan was saying that we were just a front for a sales operation, and the IRS was investigating. That scared everybody else off. But had that not happened, we'd have had like, you know, 10, 20 companies all doing this with us. And the tax court said, you're missing the point. It's not that the company you were doing this was related to the charity. That's not the problem. Any for-profit company, even if you'd had 25 companies, none of whom were related to the charity, but they were all involved in this program, the charity still would have lost its exempt status. There still would have been a substantial non-exempt purpose being pursued, and that would be enough to kill the deduction, even if the entity for which you're pursuing this benefit had no relationship whatsoever to the charity. Well, it's like I said, it's August and we're into the third part of summer. So during the August, remember August, Congress takes time off, everybody takes time off. It's time now that you can come in and take your CPE for this year. Go ahead and check what your state society has, sign up. As I said, I've got five courses coming up this month between take courses here in Arizona, courses I'll be doing in South Dakota. By the way, the South Dakota courses are also co-sponsored by the Iowa Society of CPAs. So if you're in Iowa, especially if you're in Northwest Iowa, you know, you can come in and take that course as well. But check what we've got. We've got them coming up all throughout, you know, the later in the fall. We have them through later in the fall, early winter, our courses. They'll be on all the topics. So whatever you're looking at doing, we're ready to go with you. So as I said, check in, see what's going on with CPE. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of August the 5th, 2019. As always, during the week, if we have any developments occur, we'll post them on our website, currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. If you want to follow me on Twitter, my handle there is @EdZollers. If you have questions or comments, you can email me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also find me on a number of discussion boards. I'm on a discussion board for three state societies, their Connect boards. Those societies are members of, that will include the Arizona, Minnesota, and New Jersey societies. I also take a look at California's Tax Talk group and post there from time to time. And finally, I do take a look at the /r/taxpros group in Reddit. So if you want to go there, you can also find information. And the Reddit group and the California Tax Talk group are open to, well, Tax Talk is open to any CPA or attorney. The Reddit Tax Pro is open to any tax pro. They will not let you post questions in Tax Pros. That is somebody looking for free advice who's trying to do their own return. That'll get bounced out of there. But otherwise, these are all good resources for tax professionals to bounce ideas off each other. So if you haven't taken a look at that, use that option. I'd suggest you take a look and using the option of one of these discussion groups. Or if your own state society has a discussion group, you know, look at getting involved in that. Well, like I said, it's August. Congress has left town. The House is gone. The Senate's gone. Everybody's out of town for a while. So we're not going to have anything on that. And we may still have the IRS do some stuff, and we'll keep you up on that. We'll keep you up on what the courts do. But otherwise, you know, we'll be back next week talking about whatever's going on here in the area of current federal tax development.